The Majority Report, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. Even Saturday and Sunday are casual. Sorry, Jesus. So don't forget your denim hip huggers. Don't forget your bootcut jeans. We're not afraid of dungarees on the Majority Report.
It is Friday, February 25th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting, not live, in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District. Ladies and gentlemen, I have decided to take a day off. Yes, I know yesterday it felt like I took a day off, but in fact, no, I wasn't taking a day off. I was in the studio. In fact, that's where I am right now. It is yesterday as I speak. And we had some tech work to do in the studio. You may even notice the better quality of sound of my voice right now because of all the tech work we did. But today, Friday, I have decided to take off. But I can assure you, I am obsessing about the psyops used on our senators and other leaders and the decrepit nature of our institutions, whether they are the military or just our government in and of itself. I think it's time maybe we start to wind down this empire. And I'm also, of course, thinking about the flip side of that, the people power that's going on in Wisconsin and how Governor Walker is feeling the heat just days after he got snagged in that fake Coke call. But, folks, we're going to change gears, and I have an interview that I did with the director, Eugene Jaracki, on his documentary, Reagan. And I have to say, I watched the documentary. There wasn't a lot of information in there that I didn't know about, frankly. And I think that is not the typical perspective as people watch it. It's a very interesting film. I had some misgivings about it, but I think Jaracki in the conversation turned me around. I mean, I think ultimately he is looking to demystify Reagan. And one thing, I think he mentions this on the interview, which is really interesting. He is going to be showing this film. In fact, it may have already been shown or started to be shown across our entire military forces. And so listen to Eugene Jaracki. It's a half-hour interview. And I will be back live on Monday. Next week, Chris Hedges. We'll have, I think, Krista Friedland. We're going to have so much stuff for you, folks. I can't even remember it all. So enjoy, have a great weekend, and listen, if you have an opportunity, let's say you're going to buy something from Amazon, head over to majority.fm, click on the Majority Book and DVD Shop. You don't have to buy books or DVD, you can buy anything through Amazon. You'll see a big button that says Amazon majority.fm link. Click on that link, set it up as a bookmark so that every time you buy through Amazon, you're going to be funneling money from that massive corporation, which I don't necessarily appreciate, but I do appreciate when their money goes in my pocket and supports this program, and you can be a part of that. In fact, it will only happen if you decide to do it. So check it out, and see you on Monday. And on the phone, I am speaking with Eugene Jaracki. He is an author and a stage and documentary filmmaker and a dramatic filmmaker based in New York City. His works include Why We Fight and The Trials of Henry Kissinger, among others. Thanks for joining us, Eugene.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
And of course, we're talking about your new documentary that is currently playing on HBO, Reagan, about Ronald Reagan, aptly named. So tell me, why did you set out to make this film?
Well, because I think I noticed that Ronald is so much a part of our daily conversation in America about anything that has to do with America or American politics. You can't have a conversation that lasts for more than a minute before somebody invokes Reagan. He's sort of become the what would Jesus do figure of our time. It's what would Reagan do? What would Reagan buy? How would Reagan respond to this? And I realized that very often it seemed to me when people were invoking his name, it all sounded contradictory. One person would invoke him for one thing, another would invoke him for another, and I wanted to know, well, who was the real Reagan? When is it valid to invoke him, and when is it just invoking him for the sake of making your argument sound like someone heroic has blessed it? And I wanted to get at the real Reagan.
I mean, so do you think that you ultimately found out who the real Ronald Reagan was?
I think what we did, you know, a documentary gives you the opportunity to get a bunch of people on screen, and we were able to do that with people who were very intimate with Reagan, family members, members of his cabinet, his sons are in the film, and then at the same time, people on the outside of that circle who are critical of Reagan, or even admiring of Reagan from a distance, biographers, critics, social thinkers, political thinkers. So by getting this whole kind of, there's about 30-some-odd people in the film who all weigh in on Reagan with varying viewpoints, and I think the sum total of that, I hope, is a more democratic understanding of him, reflective of the kind of range of people you could talk to across this country, but people with real command of the information. So you do get closer through learning a great deal about him. There's a lot of surprises in the film that I think people will absolutely have not known about Reagan, many of them. And then at the same time, there are nuances about who he was, his personal, you know, sort of peccadillos and personal qualities that shed, I think, a lot more light on what has become really something of a mystery.
Yeah, I mean, he's an interesting figure, and I have to say, I mean, I've seen at least three or four of your movies, your films by now, and you're a fantastic filmmaker, and it's your film work is it's beautiful. I can't tell. There were aspects of the film that bothered me, and I can't tell if it's because of my ideological predisposition against Reagan. I mean, I enter into watching it knowing that he is deified on the right and used as a sort of a touchstone, whether it's right-wing talk radio, whether it's every candidate who has ever run. It's all the, frankly, the Republican voters. I was up in New Hampshire for the primary and actually did a video where I went around and asked people, who would you rather be running today as opposed to any of the seven primary candidates in New Hampshire in 2000? And every single person said Reagan, short of one Ron Paul supporter. And so sure. He's a fascinating figure. But I sort of felt like at the end, the same thing that you talk about in terms of how aloof he was to other people almost existed in the film in a way.
Well, I wanted to be very, very careful to remember what my goal was in making the film. My goal was not to camp out a strident and extreme position to go up against what I agree is strident and extreme myth-making by those who I think shamelessly and quite fraudulently invoke Reagan's name. In other words, they go through life building statues of him. Mm-hmm. My goal was not to run around with a sledgehammer shattering those statues, because that is its own form of extremism, and I actually think the entire enterprise would become one of those enterprises that we have too many of in America that is trapped in the cult of personality. I don't care that much whether Reagan is a hero or a villain. I don't care about the whole way that we deify and vilify our public figures, because in large part that obsession is how we take ourselves as citizens out of the political equation. We either think the leader is supposed to save us or he's destroying us. And Reagan was neither. Reagan was deeply problematic for the middle-class people in this country and poor people in this country, to whom he was incredibly destructive in his economic policies, and yet at the same time would turn around and be finding a way, which no one else had found, to reach across the ocean and shake hands with Mikhail Gorbachev, become friends with him, and try to pursue significant and sincere nuclear disarmament. And are there flaws within the best of him, and are there strengths within the worst of him? Of course, he's a human being. And I thought the best thing I could do to the discourse was trying to really pursue an understanding of the real contours of the man and his thinking so that at least, it's almost like I said, could the real Ronald Reagan stand up, go over to that statue and breathe on it so that the statue becomes harder to maintain, but not because I've gone at it with my sledgehammer, but because I've let those who knew him and he himself speak to the statue and let it melt.
Yeah,
it's a very different approach.
No, I think actually, you know, my sense was when I after watching the film was that if one of those people who listen to Sean Hannity, for instance, on a daily basis, and they play clips of Reagan presented to them by the Heritage Foundation with the flute and the snare drum, you know, the Revolutionary
War drum.
Yeah, the pipe. If they watched that film, they would. I feel like their mouth would be agape. And go ahead.
It was designed to speak to people across the political spectrum. In other words, of course, it's easy to either make a film that reaffirms the views of the right wing that Reagan was a god, and it's easy to make a film for the left wing that presumes he was a devil. Well, the reality is a lot of what Reagan did, like you hear all the time in the history of American politics, are not exactly policies he invented overnight. You know, Jimmy Carter, who actually comes across rather well in the film, is to be credited, frankly, with some of the beginnings of the terrible deregulation that the left would like to fully blame Ronald Reagan for.
Absolutely.
Well, I don't like Ronald Reagan's deregulation policies, but I'm not about to pretend that he invented that in the history of American life. And if I do invent that, I will scare away reasonable people who want to finally get to a place in America where we can think about politics like grown-ups, understand that the stakes are way too high to keep pretending it's a soap opera. And if possible, if that means that I have to take the arguments in the film and present them with great care so that they are really noticeably devoid of the kind of hysteria that the 24/7 news cycle boasts, well, then so be it. I'd rather be that guy. I'd rather talk in a dulcet way. I mean, the movie reveals 15 or 20 things about Reagan that are very inconvenient for those who want to mythologize him. Mm-hmm. But it does so, I hope, carefully and with respect to the listener so that the listener can join that discourse instead of just thinking, oh, that's an opposing viewpoint that's being sledgehammered on me.
Yeah, and I think you're very effective, too, in some respects. You know, I seem to remember growing up, you know, he was referred to as having a Teflon coating. And I don't even know if I remember hearing the word Teflon in the film, but there is a sense that you create that feeling of Teflon until, of course, around Contra, which really started to scrape that shine off of him.
Yes, and it's an interesting thing that's happening. This coming Monday, on President's Day, and this may surprise people who expect a more polarized outcome to my making a film of this kind. This coming Monday, on President's Day, the Pentagon has asked for permission, and I have granted it, to show Reagan, the film, to all 1 million service people, U.S. service people stationed around the world in 170 countries on the American Forces Network, which is a closed-circuit network for the troops. The idea of being able to make a film about Ronald Reagan, which actually levies some deep criticisms of Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm. reveals that he secretly spied on his friends during the McCarthy era and named names in private to the FBI, was an FBI informant who actually was called Informant T-10, then reveals that he was willing to send a guard onto the campuses of California to crack down on student demonstrators with violence, then reveals that, you know, he made a massive political transformation in his life from being a liberal Democrat union president to ultimately becoming an arch-conservative anti-union president of the United States. These transitions and these changes about him, and then, of course, the horrors of Reaganomics in terms of its deceit of the middle class and of the poor, in which it was suggested that wealth would trickle down. If the rich got richer, suddenly that old adage that the poor would get poorer would suddenly fall away. It would prove that history was wrong. These are all things revealed in the film, and even things about the excesses in his military buildup and his covert activities around the world, such as Iran-Contra, that the military is willing to show this to the troops means that I hope something about the approach to balanced discourse that exists in the film has, in many ways, succeeded because people are responding to the film. We're getting glowing reviews for the film from clearly right-wing papers like the New York Post, which gave it 4 stars. And that is partly because alongside those criticisms, the film also has an appreciation of Reagan the man, where he came from, the changing times, how difficult it is often to be right and to end up on the right side of history, even if you have, as I think he often did, very good intentions. And I think by de-vilifying and sort of de-dramatizing the dialogue, my hope, at least, is to indicate a way of talking about politics more broadly that is richer and much more suited to the incredibly dangerous times we live in which real decisions need to be made based on a real understanding of history.
Yeah, I agree with that totally. And, you know, I definitely, I am far more interested in Reagan as measured by the implications of his policies at the end of the day than I am by him as an individual. Although, with that said, I think I actually became more interested in him as an individual after watching your film. I mean, I've had the opportunity to talk to people like Will Bunch. I've had the opportunity to talk to Ron Reagan, who I used to work with at Air America. And I've sat on the stage and interviewed Grover Norquist. And so, you know, I'm familiar with all these players in some respects. But what really struck me about your film was, and I've known the story about Boulware, who was this executive at GE, and in some ways, I think you referred to in the film, or someone referred to him as mentoring Reagan. And what really came out of it for me was an interesting question about Reagan's personal psychology. I mean, we see this guy go from a union head, I mean, about as attached to a union as you could probably be. And, you know, SAG is not necessarily the most blue-collar of unions, although I imagine it was more so at that time. And,
you know, even at that time, two things about Reagan being the president of the union of the Screen Actors Guild. One is, no, the Screen Actors Guild was not the Teamsters. It had wealthy actors in it as well as everyday people. But by and large, Reagan was also ultimately seen as someone who, in his work as president of the Screen Actors Guild, was already drifting into identifying with management. In other words, he would make deals that ultimately looked like they were a little too favorable to the producers and not favorable enough to the actors he was supposed to be representing. One already sees the beginnings of that drift in his psychology then.
And I have to say, you know, that is a there have been many SAG presidents over the years where that has always been an accusation of a lot of them, because, you know, to make that transition from actor to producer, you know, you jump that line very easily. But I mean, it was,
you know, you mentioned a moment ago, Sam, that you were interested in what the GE years said about his psychology, and it really has to do with how did a guy who called himself a hemophiliac liberal at that time, how did he, in a relatively short period of time, come to abandon his pro-union, pro-New Deal roots? This guy loved the New Deal. He loved FDR. His family had been in many ways rescued by the New Deal. How did he, within a period of 5 or 6 years, so reverse his politics that he would now become a spokesman for General Electric, using his formidable communication skills to do what General Electric wanted, which was they wanted to woo blue-collar workers away from trade unionism. They wanted to get the workers to think that they should stop identifying with the union and causing the company a nuisance, and that the company would take care of them. And by sending this handsome, affable Reagan out to the plants all around America, where he toured the plants in so many states, by doing that, it was almost a perk they were offering the workers. Reagan became one of those goodies that the company gave you. It gave you a real jolt of happiness in your day that you got to shake hands with that guy from television and the movies. So Reagan not only embodied this kind of outreach of trying to woo the workers, but when he then opened his mouth, he did the bidding of the company. And it's so interesting to watch what's happening in that period, because he is moving toward being a conservative Republican. He's moving toward identifying with management and is in many ways abandoning his roots. And does that say he's disloyal? Does that say he is one of those people, and there were many of them, who abandoned the New Deal once it got them on their feet, basically? They didn't want to pay the bill for it. Well, kind of, yes. He did not want to pay the taxes that were levied at that time. 91% marginal income tax rate, that was under Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. So you have a man who you can see has his pocketbook speaking to him because he's doing stuff for money. He also has a certain identification with the management, like you said, with producers, where he's drifting, he's crossing over. And he never really came back from that. And I think that evolution in Reagan is a very important part of understanding that anyone who tells you he is etched in stone, well, is just not reading the history. Which part of him is etched in stone? Because one of the things that his son Ron points out in the movie is, my dad's sensibilities about poor people and about caring about his fellow man weirdly stayed with him even while he was hurting people. And I don't think that Ron is just acting as an apologist for his father. What he's saying is, my dad, like a lot of people in the middle of the 20th century, when there was a shift happening surrounding the culture wars, became vulnerable to the idea, increasingly, that poor people were somehow poor because it was their fault. That even though he had been poor himself and gotten out of that and made a real go of it, he was one of those people who, I think, it's just a shortcoming of certain people that they need to wrestle with. He ultimately was willing to have blinders toward people much like himself, simply because as America was dividing at that time, he had chosen a camp that was profitable to him personally and whose worldview was conducive to the life he was trying to carve out for himself, and he didn't look back.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and that is a even more commonplace, I think, in some circles today, this whole notion of going galt and this sort of Ayn Randian libertarian groupthink, I guess, that is very prevalent today. But what struck me, and, you know, there were a couple of things that really struck me, was that here was also a guy who, according to his son, Ron, he had few friends, and here was a guy who also had, coincidentally, an alcoholic father, and there's definitely some connection between someone's relationship with their father and their eventually becoming a president, as we can see time and time again, it seems like. He also seems to me to have been very ripe to the suggestion from a guy like Boulware, who was this mid-level or upper-level executive in General Electric, who had this greater plan of endearing GE, like you say, to the workers and creating a... But based upon how much Nancy Reagan was able to dictate to him, my sense was that maybe he underwent, and this could be out of the purview of something that you're doing, but he was someone who was very ripe to be mentored in the way that Boulware seems to have mentored him.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Reagan is that his life is a puzzle between two conflicting realities inside himself. One of them is that he is very much the engineer, the director of his life. Anybody who thinks that Reagan was a puppet or an empty suit is woefully underinformed. I've just spent 3 years watching thousands of hours of footage of this person. He is incredibly smart and incredibly driven from the time he's a very young man. Reagan wrote essays as a boy that basically predicted his meteoric rise to the kind of power he ultimately reached in Washington. He was a person with a vision of his life. And ultimately, he was a person with very strong convictions, sometimes right, sometimes wrong, about the flow of world events. He had incredibly strong views about communism. He had incredibly strong views about what it meant to be an American and what this country's sort of mandate should be. This was not stuff that anybody else, you know, was programming him with. Mm-hmm. And so yet, it is interesting that if you look at him, therefore, as the director, suddenly at certain points in his life, he's absolutely willing to turn around and be an actor under someone else's direction and read their script. It's fascinating. He will go from tremendous acts of self-direction, such as everything that got him up through Hollywood and running the Screen Actors Guild, right, to suddenly saying to GE, sure, just hand me the script. I'll go up there and do what you want me to do. And at the end of the day, I think there's no question that that is just a puzzling quality about him, that there are certain issues that he's, you know, the Iran-Contra affair, he is all over that thing.
Right.
The documents that we were able to read, which are numerous, of the behind-the-scenes memoranda of conversations and the whole inner workings of the Iran-Contra affair, Reagan is not only in the room, he's running the show. Anybody who tells you otherwise is either not aware of it or trying to deceive you. Reagan was instrumental. It was his idea, much of it. And the only part that the public ultimately got distracted by was there one part of it that it could be shown he was part of an enormous multinational operation. Reagan is deeply aware of that. So there you find him in deep control. Then on another issue like AIDS or poverty, he's woefully out of the loop, letting others call the shots on that. Was Reagan actively saying to his son or to his wife or to his gay friends in Hollywood, I'm actively not going to do anything about AIDS? No. He just let it go and let cooler heads prevail around him. People who, as Ron then told me, probably would have thought to themselves, let me get this straight, gays and junkies, not our constituency. That's a direct quote from Ron. And what he's saying is, there were things in my dad's life that he was an expert on, and he was the driving force, and there were others where he let others call the shots. And it's just an interesting quality about him, and of course sometimes it brings about situations where what he ended up doing is deeply regrettable, because under the guidance of others, he, you know, ends up participating in things which are now stains on his legacy and the country's legacy. And those are, and I'm not trying to apologize for him.
Right.
I think you could also argue that he actively, you know, Ron says in the film, do I hold him accountable? Yeah. Whether he knew or he didn't know, he's the President of the United States. And I hold him accountable.
The
fact that his own son will hold him accountable means we all have
right.
the prerogative to do that. It's what we should do, because it's from that we learn. And yet it's just at the same time interesting to understand, well, what part of this is malice and what part of this is a person's shortcoming?
Right. And I'll let you go in just a moment. I know I've held you here too long. But my sense is that race was also that type of issue for him.
Yes.
I didn't get the sense from your film that he was really terribly, I mean, the most interesting thing that Ron said in the film was that when my father saw a face attached to it, he could react. But if he saw people as groups or classes, then he was detached. And in some ways, to me, that explains how this guy could go and essentially launch his campaign as the nominee in 1980, go down to Mississippi, you know, at that Neshoba County Fair, and talk about states' rights when, you know, there were three civil rights workers killed, you know, within, I don't know, hundreds of yards probably of where he was over states' rights.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's more to the contradictions of the man, which again texturize him, which undermines the campaign to make him into granite. He's a textured, living, breathing, flawed, both magnificent and flawed human, deeply flawed human being. So, but an interesting thing about that is that I didn't put this in the film because I think it would have occupied too much screen time in the telling of his full life. But during his presidency, Reagan, yes, had terrible politics about race at times, had a real blind spot about race, and had policies that were deeply damaging to African Americans in particular as a social group. Reagan at the same time had, at an individual level, one of the most remarkable things we learned was that Reagan adopted very early in his presidency a friendship with a young African-American kid in Washington, D.C., named Rudy Hines, who became his pen pal. And when I say pen pal, I don't mean he sent Rudy a couple of form letters once or twice. I mean they corresponded actively for 7 years. And Rudy wrote him letters, and he wrote Rudy letters. I've read them. I was with Rudy and saw letters from the president where he would be at the Great Wall describing to Rudy the entirety of his day with Nancy. It was about Rudy. I saw letters where he would advise Rudy about his friendships. And he had clearly taken an incredible interest in Rudy. So he didn't have an issue with Rudy as a black individual. But when you then presented him with a group of black people, or a group of poor people, or a group of people suffering from AIDS, or something like that. What his son taught us, is, and I think others corroborate this, is that on an individual basis, if you were in need, Reagan was there for you. He would give you the shirt off his back. But that when the individual would become a group, he had a blind spot where he could not anymore see that the group was just a group of individuals he might care about. And look, he's not the only person I've ever seen who has that shortcoming. I think a lot of people have that shortcoming, and especially a lot of people from that generation that was still coming up to speed, as we still are in many ways, about things like race and gender and class and the way that the sensitivities to those issues were so incredibly underdeveloped and primitive in this country that, after all, destroyed a native population and then enslaved an African population and then basically, you know, has been trying step by step by step to unlearn itself of terrible old life ways.
I actually think that group, that dynamic where people have trouble sort of empathizing with a so-called group of people is one of the fundamental pillars of ideological conservatism today, I actually think. I think that goes a long way. If you start to talk about to conservatives for an extended period of time, and I'm talking movement conservatives now, that reveals itself that when they have they look at people within the context of a group, there is no way for them to empathize with them whatsoever.
I think it's a phenomenon. I think it's fine to apply it to arch conservatives today. I think it can be applied to a lot of people.
Right.
It's important to call it what it is, and if you see a group doing it the way that arch conservatives do it, and they really do create a fraudulent, they pretend to be concerned about their fellow man in the micro and in the sort of chatter of everyday politics, but then if you look at the policy making, it clearly detaches from that. So yes, it's very worth pointing out, but it is a phenomenon. I saw it in my own grandfather. I remember that my grandfather would tell me what wonderful and close relationships he had with this individual black person or that individual black person. But you ask him about black people as a group, and he would say, "Oh, the neighborhood I lived in, they destroyed it," and such things like this. So this is a shortcoming that, you know, it's hopefully one of those things that we as a country are evolving away from. And if you see a group that is rekindling it, as I think the arch conservatives are today, honestly, they would make Reagan roll in his grave. Reagan himself, who was already somewhat strident in some of these areas, is a complete centrist compared to them.
I think you're absolutely right.
He did many things that they have no idea about, such as, you know, they tell us Reagan says Reagan would never raise taxes. Really, Reagan raised taxes 6 of the 8 years he was in office. They say Reagan would never negotiate with our enemies. Reagan prided himself on negotiating, first of all, reaching across the aisle, which he did, but also negotiating with our chief rival in the world and forming a friendship with him. They say that Reagan would have been rigid about gay rights. Really, Reagan had gay friends. He held the first gay sleepover in the White House. His interior decorator and his partner at the White House spent the night there, the first time a gay couple had ever spent a night in the White House. They say that Reagan had rigid views about abortion. Well, actually, he had somewhat a checkered history about that, including that he had signed the most progressive abortion bill in California history at the time he was governor. It goes on and on. Illegal immigration. He's supposedly a standard bearer for opposing illegal immigration. No, he supported amnesty and signed a bill that gave 2.6 million illegal immigrants amnesty in America. That real Reagan, if he's allowed to speak, will undermine those who are creating a fiction about him, and I hope do so permanently so that we can move on, we can start the world all over again, as Reagan said, with a real vision of Reagan and the world he lived in, so that we have some real lessons we can draw for today.
Eugene Jaracki, the director of Reagan, a film which is on HBO now, and I assume will ultimately be available via DVD and Amazon and iTunes.
It will. It'll come out on theatrically and home video after HBO's premiere time.
Well, I can't recommend it enough, and in fact, if you haven't seen Trials of Henry Kissinger or Why We Fight, do yourself a favor and do so. Thank you so much for joining us, and it's very exciting to hear about that, that it's going to be played for our entire armed forces. It's pretty stunning. Thank you again.
Thank you, Sam.
Choice was made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years, while I shifted in and out.